Hello and welcome back to the Undercut Podcast. We are back for our first race review of the season. And when I say we, alongside me tonight, I am, of course, Jesse Billington. I'm joined by Miss Ellie Mae Taylor and Mr. Timo Albers Daly. How are you both? And have you recovered from the wacky sleep schedules that only really Europeans moan about when it gets to the Australian Grand Prix?
No, because I then went to a Kim Wilde concert last night. So got back about 11:30. So what, got up at, I did have a nap in the day. But what, got up at 4:20 to watch the race. Back in bed at 12:30.
Ouch.
I on the other hand, did 3 all-nighters and pretty much didn't sleep at all because I thought it's a good idea this was going to be, and then I didn't immediately regret it. It wasn't as bad. Friday night, this is the thing, I don't even know what day some of it was at this point, but Friday night, I think Saturday morning was the worst of it because you had F3 and then FP3 and then F2 and then qualifying, and not much of a gap between all of them enough to give you a sufficient time to nap, so you just kind of had to get on with it. So then go to bed around 6 in the morning, wake up at 12 because your body's going, why are you still in bed at 12? And then try and go from there. So jolly good fun, and I'm going to do it probably again for China and Japan because I'm crazy, I guess.
That's the kicker, isn't it? It's like, oh, I've got to wait another week for a lion. Oh no, can't. We've got China.
That's why I thought I'll just make it really bad and then just do it properly, you know. I'm going to punish myself, embrace it.
We have China, and then we've got at least a week off before we go to Japan. So we've got a week.
And Japan isn't as bad because it's just Formula One.
Yeah, and China's not all that bad either because it's only F1 Academy we've got to try and squeeze in alongside it, not F2 and F3.
And it's a sprint weekend, which means I automatically don't care and I'll watch the highlights on Channel 4 instead of getting up for it. So in some ways, I'm over the worst of it already. But I think it was an interesting experience, and the Saturday to Sunday was not kind because it had then the 10 p.m. Formula 3 race on the Saturday night still. So your Sunday morning starts on Saturday and just really confuses you. And then you sit up until about 2 a.m. listening to Alex Brundle talk about ducks because the F2 race has been cancelled, which is excellent. I can recommend it. And I now know much more about Australian woodland ducks than I care to, care to imagine. But, you know.
Yeah, very detailed ornithology conversations about various Platyrhynchus species. But there we go. So we've all largely recovered. There wasn't a huge amount of news to come out from the weekend. The big headline sort of piece from it was the latest Formula One film trailer has been released. And we finally get some shots of Brad Pitt at Daytona. We get a shot of Brad Pitt in a 1991 Lotus, I think it is. It's a Lotus from the 1991 season. Lovely yellow with the blue camel livery to it. So we've got a bit more of an idea of the time frame for quite how all these drivers are sort of functioning, how it's all coming together. I think someone did the maths. Essentially,
Was it you?
No, someone else actually. Someone else figured out that if you took Jackie Stewart when he started the Formula One team, Stewart, he was younger when he did that than technically Brad Pitt's character is being portrayed as. So, yeah, we're looking at someone who is very senior in their years coming back to the sport to compete against a rookie. Yeah.
You want to be careful. You're dancing around the edges of ageism.
I'm not dancing around the edges of ageism. I'm dancing around...
Oh, you're just going straight for it.
I mean, you look at what the oldest driver on the grid did this year and clearly not coping well with the giant time differences, immediately crashed in the race. So I think...
You could blame Pierre Gasly for that, and straight away as an extension, it was quite a way into the race.
I don't think
if we're going to be pedantic about it.
Was Pierre Gasly for Fernando Alonso just binning
He
it?
Kicked up the gravel just beforehand and then Alonso goes immediately over it. So you could make the argument if you wanted to. I'm not blaming you personally. I'm just saying there's an argument to be made for it.
I bet George Russell thought that's karma for you.
Yeah. Almost certainly. I love the honor.
I'm sure he's not that petty anyway. He's above such things, surely.
It's the on-off relationship George Russell has with Fernando Alonso, because sometimes they're sort of out together in the clubs, and then sometimes they just seem to absolutely hate each other, and then they go back to like going out to like a club in Monaco or something.
This will be something you're familiar with, Jesse, because I'm sure there's some sort of erotic fan fiction about the two of them, and you're probably the world versus the three of us in that genre of film would support. So you let us know on that one.
I haven't read erotic fan fiction for quite some time. I don't even have
Five
But he has
minutes,
done
five, 10 minutes.
it.
I don't even have an AO3 account these days, so yeah. But anyway,
Don't even
latest
know what one of those is.
No.
clearly not online at all. But anyway, the F1 trailer is out. I'm
It
excited.
looks great.
Cinematically, it looks incredible as a film. I will give it that. It looks like it's going to be an exciting film, and I think I'm just going to have to watch
Admit it,
it.
you heard. I mean, Ellie Mae, I know you've probably still not watched it
No, I
because
have
you're
watched
you.
it.
Well, you actually did
I
watch it.
have. I
Fair enough.
have. Seeing as it was in
Nice.
our notes, I thought I'd better watch it.
I was going to say,
I thought it just looks like Days of Thunder, but Brad Pitt and F1.
Well, Days of Thunder is just Top Gun, but NASCAR.
Yes, this is essentially the third
I
version
mean,
of
I'm
Brad
up for
Pitt and
that.
F1.
And there is also the Sylvester Stallone Top Gun, but IndyCar. So this is like sort of the fifth retelling of that same story. But
They better have a good song with it then. Because you've got Show
I
Me
mean, you'd sort of say
Houston.
about a good song, they used the chain as the music for the trailer, and if that was not a good idea, then I don't know what is a good idea, because that was a great idea.
It's a good idea. I got
And
nothing.
Jesse wants to dislike it, and he
No, I
can't,
don't
and
want,
it's
it's
killing
not that I
him.
don't want to dislike it. I like so many of the creative decisions this film is making. I love the effort that's gone into it cinematographically, editorially. A lot of it to me really appeals. There are certain bits that are jarring. One, Brad Pitt's character's age. Two, why the hell does he seem to have a relationship with his female race engineer? Or like, that feels
You'll have to watch the film and find out. We're not going to tell you everything in one go, are we?
no,
Spoilers.
but everything
That's
else.
what gets you in the cinema.
Everything else about the film actually looks quite exciting, and as sort of a bit of a cinephile, something I will enjoy watching because the creative process that's gone into this has been incredible. It's got some great names attached to it. Jerry Bruckheimer, who's doing the, is it Hans Zimmer that's done the theme music
Yes.
for it? He is a great score sort of composer when it comes to these sort of things. Think about some of his best work. He worked with Klaus Bode when it came to doing the Pirates of the Caribbean stuff. He's done a lot of nature documentaries. This guy has scope, and from what we've seen so far, it's looking great.
I do think as well that Ferrari have incorporated some of the film angles to their car already. You look at some of the filming footage that you saw from Fiorano, I think, when Lewis made his debut, and some of the placements of the cameras on there look like ones that they used in the film. And I don't recall seeing them in F1 footage anywhere before then. And I wonder if his involvement to the film's there as well. And I look at Jack Doohan's Alpine, it's similar to K-Max Haas last year. The position just behind the cockpit of the camera is slightly further back now and gives you a bit more scope, and it looks a lot better than the immediate one there that most of the cars have. And it feels a bit more. You get that speed that you got only in the trailer, but you now get it in the actual racing, which is weird that it's gone that way around. But I like that we've now got it in a few different ways.
Art influencing life. I think the camera teams for Formula One and the TV crews have started relocating a lot of the cameras down to that lower side point and using a slightly wider angle lens because the atmosphere you get as stuff rushes past the car is part of what communicates its speed on screen. And by incorporating that broader angle that gives you a bit more of the track, a bit more of the scope, a bit more of seeing other cars come past, gives you that feeling of space and speed and sort of
Well,
relativeness.
it's what I've wanted them to do for a while, but not quite in the same way that IndyCar have with their camera that goes most of the way around most of the
Rotating
time. You see it a little bit in F1, but not very often, whereas IndyCar, pretty much every race, you see it the whole way and you get this
NASCAR
beautiful
has
shot around.
rotating cameras as
Yeah,
well.
they've got a bit of that, yeah.
And again, it gives you that sort of the scope. Also, puts you a bit more in the driver's eye as you sort of move it around. It's why I like that we've had like
It's ironically a lot better than Driver's Eye.
a lot better than the problem is you're using such a scaled down camera there. You struggle to work the clarity of it. But I know with the filming of the F1 film, they have the cameras rigged ahead of the drivers and shot back, and it was down to Brad Pitt and I can't remember his co-star's name, to sort of rig and fire off the cameras when they're doing some of the shots. So you did have these cameras that gave you like a lower down looking into the cockpit style, but again, a lot of it has sort of reverberated out. But a lot of this, I will maintain, you can stem back to Grand Prix, the 1966 film, which is phenomenal. And I do recommend people go back and watch because that featured
Everyone.
Hill in it, everyone from the 60s that was racing, the fact that the effort that went into it, the fact that it was very hugely backed by, I think, Honda at the time, and the fact that a lot of the actors actually got good enough at racing that they were starting to turn competitive lap times. I know Carroll Shelby did a lot of the driver coaching for that. So all of a sudden, I think it was James Gardner might have been the actor in this one, was able to turn competitive lap times with sort of the midfield of the 1966 racing teams. And you're sort of going, okay, that is getting involved. But also, it revolutionized the way that sport was filmed. We started elevating cameras, we started putting them on helicopters, we started getting them to track with stuff. Now it's de rigueur to find helicopters buzzing around an F1 circuit filming the action. Prior to that point, it had always been static, locked off shots, and a car would come past it and someone would do the commentary. This pioneered putting the cameras on the cars, moving the cameras, getting them to different locations. So a lot of the great stuff we're seeing in this film can be traced back to, again, this is me getting too involved in cinema.
I was going to say one last thing before we move on. I just wanted to say, anyway, how much will you laugh if, as a result of all this, in the same way that in the 1960s the actors got that good, how much will you laugh if Cadillac hire Brad Pitt next year just to annoy him?
I don't know, I'm just so
She's torn
pessimistic.
between it's silly, but it would annoy Jesse.
I'm just so pessim I don't know why I'm so pessimistic against this movie. I just am.
I blame Jesse. You started this. You were pessimistic from the start, and you've clearly
No,
worked up.
I think it stems from watching the Ferrari movie with Emilia Emilia and picking apart that, and now I'm just like,
Different director, the whole different
I know, and it's
kettle of
not based
fish.
on like true story either, but it's, I think.
And I think everyone expected a certain film with Ferrari that they didn't get, whereas this one, if that turned into a character study, we'll all be very surprised.
Yeah, we'll see how it pans out. I'm
So that's a
excited.
bit on the fence of the division if they hire Brad Pitt or not. We'll come back to that. Silly season.
That'd be the silliest of silly seasons. Anyway, we'll focus a bit more on the weekend at hand. And the big headline coming out of the weekend, aside from its actual results, is the fact that Max Verstappen loses his championship lead, which he has held since the Spanish Grand Prix in 2022. It is a phenomenal amount of time. It's something like 1,000 days that he has technically never been usurped from the top of a championship. And Lando Norris now becomes the first McLaren driver to lead the championship since Lewis Hamilton did in 2012, I think it
Oh.
is. Yeah, so we're seeing a few changey bits come through this season, and it's exciting. It's getting us off on the right foot. If you're a script writer, this is how you'd be doing it. But again, depends what the script writer writes for China. Hopefully something better for Ferrari. But yeah, what do we think about this very, very early sort of shoots of a potential flowering of something exciting this year?
It's
I don't think
inevitable now.
I can take it. I don't think my nerves are going to take it. I think it's going to suddenly be stressful this entire season.
It's definitely going to be one that's going to keep us on tenterhooks. I'll say that much. Timo?
Not much to add, really. I think it was inevitable it was going to happen at some point, and I'll be surprised if it doesn't change several times over the course of the season. It's going to be one of those seasons I feel where it is close, but the entire Grand Prix, I feel, can be summed up by the still photo that was taken from the race of both Piastri and Lando going off as the rain was coming down, going, these are great drivers, don't get me wrong, but they're in the best car and they're going off. And just in the background, you've got Max Verstappen dragging that Red Bull to places that it clearly doesn't belong in, and you're going, that's why this isn't going to be straightforward this year.
Yeah,
They
we're
were
going to.
first onto the scene, though, to be fair to them. At least Max could kind of see them going off and think, I
I don't
better
think it
back
would have
off.
mattered.
I think it plays a huge advantage. You watch someone else go
It's
skittering.
an advantage, but I don't think Verstappen would have been caught out either.
He has been caught out previously. He was caught out by Piastri. Piastri put pressure onto Verstappen early on in the Grand Prix, and Verstappen missed his braking marker on a damp and greasy circuit and ended up on a runoff. Like,
Different situation, but yes.
it's not a different situation. It's the same Grand Prix and the same group of drivers.
Same Grand Prix, same, yeah, but it's not, oh, it suddenly started here and I'm distracted by that. He's focusing on the driver ahead of him. He's not fighting a driver at that point in time. He's just getting nearer to them.
But it's that thing of he's not going to be completely untouchable this season. There are going to be moments where we're going to have to accept that
I
all of
didn't say it would be.
the fallibility of Max Verstappen is a much more tangible thing and something that needs to be factored into the way that we discuss his performances. We can't just go, it's Max Verstappen dragging a tractor up there. I think every now and then we are suddenly going to notice, because he is no longer in that best car, those moments where he does make the difference, but also those moments where that difference is noticeable. We started to see that with Sergio.
And I'm saying that there's also not a guarantee that because you've got the best car, A, the McLaren, that you're going to be able to just swan off into the distance as both have improved in that corner.
No.
That was all I was saying.
Sounded a bit more bootlicky towards Red Bull, which I think is something that people
Me bootlegging to Red Bull, I don't think so.
No, but this is something that I think is going to become an incredible part of the discourse around this season is as everyone goes, oh, look at what Max Verstappen's able to do. And you sort of go, yes, he's able to do that because he's a generational talent, but we're still going to start seeing those moments where it falls apart. And it's that difference as to when things start to fall apart that seem to set apart drivers. That was long the discussion that was held around Sergio Perez when the car had to be sort of worked back a few steps against the field to try and find a better development pathway. They went the wrong way, it got stymied. That was when we started to notice other drivers fall apart. But that was when we noticed it with the likes of Pierre Gasly, with Alex Albon, is you had a car that had sort of taken a few wrong turns developmentally. Max, because he is that cut above the rest, is able to drive around that. But that doesn't mean that he is sort of the purest of white snow, 100% clean. There are going to be moments where that goes wrong. And I think Oscar Piastri had an incredible drive this weekend that very much proved that. And I mean, we'll get to the rest of the drivers, but first, we ought to sort of touch on one of the bigger questions of the weekend, which was how will the rookies do? This is the first time in forever, it feels like, since 2010 that we've had this amount of rookies joining the field. And especially with the challenging conditions, it was a big question. How will these guys cope? So we figured who better to ask about it than friend of the show, Martin Villari.
Yeah, look, it was a massively disappointing weekend from all of the rookies in some way, shape, or form. I think they all really, to some extent, underperformed, with the exception of Kimi Antonelli, who I think, he got fourth and that's all he was going to get, even though he made a couple of mistakes himself. I think it's quite evident and obvious that these teams don't have specialist driver coaches and mentors present. Because there's no clear direction, goals, and objectives for the weekend. We all know Melbourne is a street circuit. It's important to build and put together a weekend. It's important to complete the weekend. And particularly when it's raining in a street circuit like Melbourne, it's important to just stay alive. And these are basic mindset kind of philosophies that each of the rookies should be holding, but aren't holding. Now, I don't necessarily blame them for that. That's more got to do with the team and who they employ and who their advisors are. But I think sometimes the teams are too heavy on the engineering side and not heavy enough on the human side. Now, technically speaking, with Ollie Bearman's crash in the practice session, obviously it was just in the change of direction, getting a weight transfer from the left to the right, and then coming across the car, spinning the rear around. And then obviously the left rear on the grass on the entry into braking into turn 11. But then all of the other issues, Bortoleto's crash, Liam Lawson's crash as well. Antonelli put right rear on the grass in the race as well. So these some of the other crashes like Hadjar's and Lawson's was just about really slow speed throttle introduction when the steering wheel is not straight, when the downforce is not active, introducing the throttle in the right way. The likes of, Hamilton, Verstappen, Norris, Piastri, these guys know that in those traction zones, the cars are very clumsy. You just need to stay alive. You've got 1,000 horsepower underneath your right foot, zero downforce active at, 0 to 40 kilometers per hour. That's the most critical part. My advice to all of them moving forward would be not to try to be a racing driver, because that involves being quick, being erratic, being on the edge, being on the limit, none of which will serve you. My advice to all of them is try to be a champion. And that's a totally different mindset, because that comes in with methodology, with thinking, with analytics, with curiosity, with problem solving, with delivery of results. And I think if they think in that way, they're more likely to get favorable outcomes.
Some interesting points from Martin. How do we think the drivers are going to be sort of learning from this, picking up on this, or do we think that the teams are too sort of rooted in their ways and unwilling to change the way they sort of frame their driver's focuses across a weekend.
I think that Martin's comments are complemented by the different reactions to Hadjar's crash in particular from Anthony Hamilton and Helmut Marko. So if you didn't know any better, if you were just as an outsider looking at this, which one of those do you think worked for the team that hired and developed that driver, and which one do you think would just be another driver's father in that capacity because he doesn't have any actual associations, he's not a team member in any respect there, and I think that tells you a lot of what you need to know there. My other thing is that, again, maybe situation dependent a lot of the time, but I think Bortoleto has the least pressure as a result of all of this, because while he is an F2 champion and an F3 champion straight off the back of that as well, he's in, arguably, we can debate that as well later after Haas, but the worst car on the grid. So there's no pressure on him in the way that there is on someone like Antonelli, in the way that there is on someone like Lawson and Hadjar to that extent because of the program that he's in. And those are just interesting things which I was thinking about when listening to Martin.
Sort of when Martin was sort of saying how, you know, they need driver coaching to teach them that in these, you know, how to cope in these conditions. And then he sort of compared it to how Norris and Verstappen and whatnot went round. I think it's difficult to compare them, that kind of thing, because it's like, yes, I will always say that maybe drivers do need a driver coach or someone like, you know, how Lewis had Angela Cullen for so many years. But at the same time, you can't replicate what happens on track as such outside of that situation. So I think the only way they're going to learn from these is experiencing them in the races themselves. And unless you get those experiences in the race, okay, it's quite unfortunate that it was the first race of the season.
I think it's a good thing it was the first race of the season, though, because
just throw them in at the deep end.
They got to learn quickly. We had this with Behrman last year, but I mean, I know he crashed in Baku, I think, but after that, whenever he turned up in the same Colapinto straightaway, they had like comfortable-ish runs, and then Brazil comes along and just goes, no, I'm going to show you what Formula One's like sometimes, and we're just going to throw you into a wall. And if you don't have the experience or the capability to deal with that, then you're gone. And as Australia showed again, even if you do have all of that, that's not a guarantee that you're going to get out of whatever slippery situation you're in unscathed, as Alonso showed. So I think, yeah, unfortunately it was the first race, but glad now because it's kind of the best, worst time to do it.
There's never a good time to make those sort of mistakes, but the best time to make those sort of mistakes is the first weekend, because especially on a track that none of them have really raced on before, in conditions that are incredibly challenging, on a circuit that had been largely resurfaced as well, so it did not have a lot of rubber on it, that would have been washed off with a lot more painted lines on it. And Alex Albon made the great point of, he said, the white lines that are painted down for the race weekend, the ones that define the edge of the track, are incredibly grippy. It's an incredibly aggressive, abrasive paint that's laid down, that if you've ever touched circuit lines, you'll notice that it's almost like they've sort of got shards of glass and sand in them. It creates a very, very grippy surface. And then as soon as you compare that to the standard road markings that we have in the UK, they're almost sort of waxy and very slick. And you can imagine as soon as there's water on that, it becomes a very tricky surface to try and control. If you've ever ridden a bicycle in the rain over sort of a painted surface, you know it's an absolute nightmare. So you multiply that up by a sort of a factor of thousands by the time you get to the horsepower, but do not get anywhere close to that when it comes to your footprint of tyre. You can understand the problems that the rookies are going to be facing. It's not an easy weekend to start on, so making those mistakes is fair, I would say.
And just to complement what Olivier was saying there as well, Behrman made those mistakes as early on in the weekend as you can, and was one of the only two rookies that survived the entire race. Sure, he didn't get any points out of it, but I was going to say he didn't damage the car, but he already had severely damaged the car up to that point, but he didn't make it worse. It's kind of he did kind of another weirdly best version of the worst situation. Mm. But, you know, you'd rather crash in practice and then crash again in practice and then not make it out in qualifying to then at least survive the race and deal with the conditions, which ironically were much worse than any of the other conditions that he'd been out in so far. But maybe he learned something in there, and that'd be quite interesting to see if he did and how he did and what he did in the interim, because like you say, there's no one obvious in that team that we can point at and go, oh, you're helping him with this.
I think with Ollie, it's a good one because in the dry, the breakaway conditions, the breakaway levels for those cars is that much higher. So when the car is going to snap, when it steps out, when it loses traction, you're pushing it further beyond its limit. So you're more comfortable when it starts to do that behavior at a lower speed, at lower throttle inputs. So you're more able to then sort of try and fight it back. Obviously, you're dealing with a far less sort of greater period of traction. So you haven't got as much time or necessary scope to catch it, but it's operating on smaller inputs. So you've got more reach to gather it all back up again. But there is an absolute limit to that. We saw that with Hajar, the fact that even the smallest of sort of overthrottle applications will just send you round and very unfortunately into the barriers on a formation lap. It's unfortunate that's how it goes. But again, yeah, Behrmann, I think you're right, Timo, in saying that he sort of got his learning out the way very early on and sort of an odd way to do it in those conditions. But I think it played favorably to his hand by the time the Grand Prix started and those conditions changed immensely. With the rookies out of the way, we'll of course mention them as we go through our team by team analysis. No point reading back the race to you. If you're listening to this, chances are you very much watched the race or at least watched a highlights package of it. So have a decent understanding of it. So we'll dive into our analysis. And I've structured it as we had towards the end of last year in championship order for the teams, which yeah, I've got them in the correct order, means that we start with McLaren, who oddly enough are tied with Mercedes on points. McLaren, though, Norris qualified on pole with Piastri next to him. And then Norris finished P1 and Piastri managing just to sneak it into P9. So, Timo, how do we feel about McLaren after that first weekend?
Is on the completely neutral and as a McLaren fan generally, regardless of whoever is driving for them at any point in history, but I'm quite like that McLaren's at the top again, or at least competitive at the top, because obviously I'm not necessarily expecting them, and for my predictions, they're not going to be there by the end of the season, but I like that they're at the sharp end. And it was essentially a perfect qualifying and practice session and almost race for them. Didn't like the immediate use of team orders. I can understand why they were used in such a circumstance because of the lap traffic coming their way. But you should be able to trust your drivers quite maturely and in the team's best interest in a situation like that. And for it to come out immediately in race one was a bit for me. And while personally he's not my cup of tea, Lando has improved. And I do think this was his best Grand Prix today and his best victory. He was under pressure at the end, as we saw. He didn't make any mistakes. He actually remembered to defend straight into turn one on the first lap and didn't lose it into the first corner as we're so used to him doing, and didn't seem too bothered by anything, which was just uncharacteristic. I know Ellie May's written in the notes, shut up, because I've complimented him in a backhanded sort of way, but it's a weird pleasant surprise because I think last year on several occasions I compared him to Leclerc in 22 and was wondering when he would learn the same things that Leclerc did, and we have seen that he has learned since then. And you know, it's only one Grand Prix, but so far so good.
I mean, Ellie May, you go first.
They've certainly started the season dominantly. I mean, no one can match their current pace at the moment unless, I don't know, Ferrari get a better setup. We will wait and see for that. But yeah, Norris didn't put a foot wrong. And I think, again, it's a bit like how kind of Martin was talking about the rookies and kind of then what I said in response is that until you're in that position where you're sort of maybe fighting for wins and fighting for a championship, you can't sort out your mentality until you go through it. So Norris has probably learnt from his mistakes and what he did right from last year and is now hopefully then going to put it into this year, which I think he did in this race. And then Piastri, just so unfortunate, but I think the main thing to take away is that he didn't give up. He could have thrown in the towel when he was struggling to get off the grass, but he didn't. And he came back fighting and he put in a bold move in that overtake against Hamilton.
Jeremy Clarkson coming in to save the day there.
His tractor reversing skills paying off. I mean, yeah, Ellie May sort of sort of echoing some of my thoughts that I'd sort of written out, it was sort of peerless weekend for McLaren, I think. Max was at points struggling to touch both of them, and their setups, their understanding of their car just looks so well defined, and their ability to turn on the tyres far better than any of the others really came in handy, especially when we had that running on slick compounds. Look at how quickly they had the hards fired up after that safety car compared to Max's mediums. And yeah, it's a shame it all came undone for Piastri with that heavy downpour that caught out a lot of drivers. If you've seen any of the fan cams of other cars getting to that set of corners, and the amount of drivers that have either gone wide straight through that gravel, and thankfully it arrived at it at a much lower speed, so it didn't have the momentum to carry them on into the next set of sort of grassy compounds, or drivers that simply just looped it and had to just sort of crawl their way out of the gravel. It was like 50% of every car, every sort of pack of cars that came past had someone or at least two people going through there. So it's not surprising that it bit Piastri more out of the pair of McLaren drivers. Wrong place, wrong time for all of that, really. The downpour, wrong point on the track. It is one of the slicker parts of the track. I think it is the bit that had always been resurfaced, so it was going to be the worst to react to that rain. And yeah, then trying to extricate yourself from the slick grass on slick tyres in the rain is never going to be easy. And yeah, like anyway, I said, it would have been all too easy just to throw in the towel, lob the wheel from the cockpit and storm off. But I think there's something to be said for his... It's not Piastri. There's something to be said for his fortitude and his ability to sort of go, no, we'll rebuild, we'll go again. And to then make your way from the back of the pack all the way through and into the points and sling one past Lewis Hamilton in the wet, that's a pretty tidy little move. And I think the mentality he showed this weekend, as much as he's beating himself up for it, I think his mentality speaks far greater than his racing here. And his racing spoke a lot.
Well, that's why the team orders frustrated me so much, because I just thought, A, listen, 2 minutes beforehand, Zach's just said, we're not going to do team orders. So then immediately, like, why? Piastri clearly knows what he's doing, and you want to see him race against Norris, because we've not seen too much of that, really, and we don't know what that looks like. And again, kind of leads into what I was going to say about Norris just going back slightly, is the one thing we haven't seen yet, because we haven't had the opportunity, we nearly got it here, is what's he learned in how to fight Verstappen wheel to wheel, because if Verstappen only managed to get close to him, he had a couple of looks, but he never got the chance to actually really fight him. It was very akin to Imola in reverse from last year. It's kind of, you're getting near to the point of doing battle, but not literally there. So that's going to be interesting to see how that develops. And then when Piastri comes into the mix, either with Verstappen, so I don't think we've seen too much of that either, and with Norris, then that's going to be where the fun really starts. And at that point, good luck giving team orders to either of them, because I think they'll both go kind of down the Carlos Sainz route and go, oh, my radio's just not working, I can't hear you, sorry. I'm going through a tunnel while hanging up on you.
I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think that Red Bull will have the car this season to match the McLaren to really fight them. Unless Max is ahead of Norris or Piastri on track, I don't think we're going to see strong battles between
them. I'd agree with that, but I'm thinking maybe if we get similar conditions where it's leveled out a bit more, because China and Japan in particular, we're used to them being interchangeable conditions, and at that point everything's a bit more fair game. But if we're looking at Bahrain, for example, yeah, that might be a bit trickier, unless Red Bull somehow managed to pull something out. But I'll come back to that in a bit.
But then you saw how much McLaren went off into the distance once were passed.
We said this about Red Bull at the start of the season last year, and we thought no one can possibly catch them, and then look what happened.
But a strong start to the season is often all you need. I think Japan will be an interesting one. If Japan is dry, as it might be, but again, we're doing Japan in the springtime, there is no way of guaranteeing that. That'll be the first sign. If not, like you said, Timo, it's going to be Bahrain before we truly know the gulf in performance between the McLaren and the Red Bull. But yeah, China, it's going to be another greasy circuit. It's going to be relatively chilly, and there is every chance.
And it's a sprint weekend.
And it's a sprint weekend, so you don't get the setup, you don't get the practice, but we do get a lot of that wheel-to-wheel opportunity, whether we see the McLaren going up against sort of Max, we'll wait and see. But Max is fighting sort of single-handedly up there. You look at the McLaren, they have got two cars that look like they're going to be able to consistently perform up at the spicy end of the grid.
But you need them to play together and not against him if he comes into it, and that's where the trick is going to be.
Yeah, there is a lot to see, but all in for me, McLaren are carrying on their championship winning ways from last year. And while I'm worried for dominance, I do technically like their ruthless performance and would like to see more of it, see how they're able to hold on to it. We know how Red Bull, we know how Mercedes can control a championship. How can the modern McLaren control a championship? That's what I'm looking forward to. Meanwhile, tied on points at the top of the standings on, was it 27 or something?
Seven.
Overall, we've got Russell who qualified P4 and Antonelli who qualified P16 and then went on to finish P3 and P4, respectively. It's, of course, Mercedes. Timo.
Think the only team that can actually be truly happy with this weekend, Russell, very anonymous drive, but one we're a little bit used to from him at this point in some respects when he's really dialed in. He had some minor issues in FP1. But apart from that, it just went really well for him. We barely saw him on the coverage, and that's usually a sign that you're doing all right. Antonelli did drop the ball crucially in qualifying, but as we all know, it doesn't really matter where you start, which is really probably a theme of this episode in a lot of ways. It's where you finish that counts, and he was impressive. I've obviously been on the fence about him for a good while, and I think I'm still on the fence. But I'm more leaning one way than the other right now because credit where it's due, he did a very, very good job. Both drivers in the top five, they're kind of in their own league as they have been Mercedes for most of time since 2022. And I think they maximized the potential that they had without making any critical mistakes. Russell, I don't know if it's too soon to say this or not, but a little bit like Norris, he reminded me of Leclerc in 24 when it finally showed that he'd learned a lot of lessons from past and he was now applying them. So quite happy with it. And though Antonelli, the one thing I will just say on that one is that while obviously qualifying only matters so much, I did laugh when Bortoleto of all drivers knocked him clean out of qualifying straight away because I just thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if Bortoleto somehow managed to oust Antonelli and then about 2 seconds later he did and went, oh, fair play. Wasn't expecting that, but that's quite funny.
Yeah, Timo, I certainly echo your points on Russell having a slightly anonymous performance. But I think given the weekend, if you're flying under the radar and coming home with a strong set of points, anonymity in this scenario isn't bad. And Antonelli, the
Not
absolute
just because we can't see you in the rain.
no, and Antonelli, the absolute standout for me, a rough qualifying that just didn't pan out his way. And like you said, Bortoleto getting the pinch on him in that session. But he set about quickly rectifying that. And in the race, while all around were losing their heads, he stayed pretty clear-minded. And that little spin post-Hulk overtake the first time shows how much Melbourne was biting the uninitiated. But then to post one back past a very experienced driver in exactly the same place in slightly worse conditions, incredibly ballsy and incredibly brilliant. His very
Did confuse Martin Brundle because
he
he thought
did
he was watching a replay.
one because it was like for like the move. And if you're a driver getting done by the same driver like for like, that's got to be a little bit
Well,
infuriating.
you may be expecting this a similar move. You're not expecting it to be 100% identical. So if you're
Yeah.
thinking, well, he's not going to do exactly that again, son of a bitch.
I'm sure Martin will agree with me, though, when I say that consistency when it comes to driving is key. It's also something that George Russell will stand by. If Antonelli's coming in his first race in those conditions and being able to be that consistent when it comes to making an overtake up the inside in the wet, we're looking at something quite exciting here. Yeah, clean, quiet, no fuss or theatrics. I love it. And I'm scared that he will get seated in Formula One properly and a period of quality engineering for Mercedes could herald some dangerous waves of victories from him. So, a lot to look forward to from where I stand.
Whenever there's chaos, George Russell always seems to be the one to scoop up a podium, isn't he?
He
He's
loves it.
always
You say
there.
that Imola of what was it, 22, 23? That wasn't so much
No.
podium in chaos, was it?
No.
He's
He
learning, though. That backs
created.
up my point. Excellent.
No, Imola of 21.
21? I forget.
George Russell.
I'm thinking whenever he did
Kimi
Bottas.
Raikkonen was still there.
Yeah, 21 was the George Russell wet chaos and clattered into Bottas going through Tamburello.
But the Russell in this.
Surely that was 22 then, I thought. I thought because 21 would have been him going to the wall anyway. Or was that 20?
No, 21 was when he clattered into Bottas. And
Seems like such. It didn't seem that long ago. We're getting old, guys.
With him smacking Bottas on the head and Bottas giving him the middle finger. Meanwhile, elsewhere on the
Now,
circuit.
who's saying he was his number one fan? We know what this means now.
Oh,
It's
of
been
course.
established.
Yeah, forgot about that. Yeah, of course it means that was turn one, you idiot. Yes, of course it was turn one. Yeah. But yeah, Ellie Mae, your thoughts on Mercedes?
That was it, really.
Oh, just George Russell loves to capitalize on a bit of chaos and sure.
Yeah.
Does, yeah.
Antonelli, I'll get onto later. So, yeah.
Meanwhile, Red Bull, Verstappen qualified P3 and Lawson qualified P18. And results sort of carry on in that same vein with Verstappen finishing P2 and Lawson DNFing. And I feel that I ought to start with this one. Otherwise, the notes that I've sort of seen written in front of me won't make a great deal of sense because Timo will shout at me if I say anything about Lawson, given the bickering match we had.
I've established I won't.
Well, we had a fair bickering match about it in the Instagram comment section.
Nice calm, nice calm voices, though. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, but I feel like I do want to clarify my position on the prediction about Red Bull swapping him out. And it's not personal. It's more of a statement about Red Bull's typically rash actions when it comes to underperforming drivers, regardless of circumstance. And this weekend was circumstance that ought to be not ignored. Thrust into a car he's only driven in testing at a top team that's licking its wounds from a cutting blow in 2024. The pressure on Lawson is enormous, and then shoved out onto track he doesn't know from behind the wheel in the wet, littered with a lot of white lines crisscrossing a recently repaved surface. It was never going to be easy. Then when another deluge falls and everyone is on the wrong tyres, having gambled against the forecast, I can't say I'm surprised he ended up arse first in the wall, though he does very much have my sympathy for it. And I want him to rebuild. I want him to come out swinging in China, though that's another new track to him and one that's also likely to be wet. So it's still an uphill battle for him. I don't think it's going to be fair should something happen to him at Red Bull's hand this season, because the performance he's putting in I think the effort he's putting in is not being accurately represented in the results we're seeing on paper. Max, meanwhile,
it's like he's a rookie.
Yes.
I was thinking the same thing.
Mm.
But
which, by the way, there was a graphic. I
on
don't know
Sky,
if you saw
right.
this. Yeah. No, from the official F1 feed there on my Sky, they're just showing what F1 is putting there. And it was a list of rookies and remind me anyway, who's on that list?
Well, do you know what, Timo? I took a picture.
I did as well.
This is his first time competing reportedly in an entire season of Formula One. But there we go.
I mean, reportedly, he's never competed in a full season of Formula One before.
Yeah, but he might not complete this entire season, is what I'm potentially hinting at again because of the brashness of Red Bull. But we'll get to that in a different point in time.
Wouldn't that still make him a rookie, though?
Yes. By that metric, because he's not completed a full season of Formula One, he is a rookie. Anyway, Max, meanwhile, simply Max. Though that Red Bull does look to have a few rough edges even in his hands. So it's an interesting sort of trying to pick apart Red Bull. Two very different drivers, one very different car to what we've seen from them before, and add in some tricky conditions. It's not an easy set of tea leaves to read.
Not an easy set of tea leaves to read, but turnaround that Verstappen had from Friday to Saturday was fantastic and shows that while they're still compromised, they're not a team and he's not a driver that should be counted out. Because despite the vast improvements that McLaren have made, and we saw that, the fact that Verstappen was only a fraction of a second behind Norris at the end of the Grand Prix shows that it still won't be plain sailing for Lando or McLaren as a whole. Verstappen, yeah, you kind of touched on this already, but I think in the same way that he did it last season, even if the car's not completely there, he's still going to wring the neck from it to get what he wants out of it. In the same way that Piastri did them with the McLaren towards the end, he's not going to give up simply because it's stacked against him. So that's going to be quite interesting to watch there. And I think the fact that even with such an almost faultless weekend from McLaren, the fact that Verstappen can be that close, albeit in mixed conditions, I don't predict that that's going to be the same in Bahrain if we have a dry race there, is still very intriguing for the season. Lawson, yeah, I agree with you that he's probably going to be on the back foot in China as well because of the fact that it's all new and everything. So I think that Japan, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia will be where I start to judge him a bit more, as he'll be in locations that he's raced at previously. And he'll also have had a couple of Grand Prix under his belt already at that point to get to grips with Red Bull and the new team. I'm not too worried about him though. I think he's someone where he's in that second seat, but I don't think there's the same pressure on him that there is or has been with other drivers before. Perez, obviously vastly experienced, was not expected to be able to beat him. He was expected to support him, and I think that's all that they want from Lawson. And as we saw with, okay, didn't really see with Hunter because he didn't make it far enough to do anything, but with Yuki, he can qualify well, but he still didn't make it into the points either. And it shows that even with that level of experience, you can still finish outside of the points if you finish at all. And so it was not a great weekend to beat any of those drivers unless you're Verstappen. So at the moment, I'm still very much not Team Lawson in the sense that you've got to choose a side, but I can still understand perfectly well why they chose Lawson over Yuki, because this was a race where it would have been perfect with that qualifying that Yuki had to go and show it to them, but he's always been a stronger qualifier than he has been to finish a race in a decent or similar position.
I kind of reiterate kind of what you're both saying, and I'll admit I thought this Red Bull was going to be a pig of a car this year, but I think Verstappen has proved why he's a world champion. He can make the car work even in the trickiest of conditions, and like you both said, I'm going to give Lawson the benefit of the doubt, mainly because he was on slick tires on a wet track. Others went off when they were on the right tire for the conditions, let alone the wrong ones.
It's a mixed bag, and
Have you also seen that Verstappen's become a father to Kimi Antonelli? He's getting.
there are so many sort of the juniors that just sort of agglomerate to him. However, I think the age gap to from Verstappen to Antonelli is the same age gap from Verstappen to Kelly Piquet. So,
8 years, is it?
I believe that to be correct, although I can't think of the numbers off the top of my head, but they are. I'll leave you to ruminate on those figures for a little while. Meanwhile, after Red Bull, as I scroll down the list, we get to Williams next, which is an odd place to find them, but a
But
joyful.
everybody likes this.
Yes, yeah,
Yeah.
no one's complaining. Alex Albon qualified P6 and Carlos Sainz P10. And in the race, while Carlos Sainz did exit early with a slight unexpected power delivery on a upshift that saw him skating into the wall backwards, Alex Albon soldiered on and finished P5, though very temporarily he did finish P4. But Antonelli's penalty for an unsafe release was eventually overturned once Mercedes went. If you look at the rest of the camera angles, it shows you he was nowhere near Hülkenberg.
Which is curious that that race control wouldn't have done that, considering it's their job. But
They didn't
again,
have
it's
that.
so unlike them to make mistakes anyway that I'll leave them off for that one.
They claim they didn't have access to those camera angles, but I'm like, but it's not like you're waiting for the
Your
film
race
camera
control.
onto them and be developed and then handed to you to play back. It's
Nice
digital.
cutbacks in the budget, that is what they do now.
It's all done on like sort of little rollies of emails.
You remember the cars, remember the people, sorry, that they used in Grand Prix to film it? They just lob them on the front of the car. That's what they do
Gaffer
now.
tape a man with a camera to the side. I forgot the cost cap and all that. Anyway, Albon finished P5, a great result for the team, and I'm going to wait a little longer to serve judgment on that Williams, but Albon looked pretty happy with it this weekend, as at points did Carlos Sainz. There's a unity and a drive in Williams as an outfit this season, it seems, and now they aren't combating a lopsided driver pairing each weekend. They might stand a chance. Alex's efforts were brilliant, and Carlos looked to quickly be getting settled in the car. It's a shame that his session ended so early, but his work with the team on the strategy, being able to coach them on sort of what a driver wants in the certain sort of climatic conditions, and just sort of help sort of solidifying those calls, just made the overall performance of the outfit a lot stronger than I think it really could have been that weekend. There is more to come, I feel. Alex's result is the best finish for a Williams since Lance Stroll banged in a P3 in Baku in 2017, if we assume that it's a race that's run its full distance. So while the car has improved, I hope that not too much effort has been poured into it instead of the 2026 car's development. I think also this is Alex Albon's best result since. Quite a long time away. 2020 would have been his last full season where he
I'll
hadn't.
say potentially Mugello podium, potentially somewhere around there. It's
Yeah.
in that neck of the woods, result wise, I'd say.
Yeah, somewhere in the tail end of 2020. Let's see how long ago it would have been. When did he last finish somewhere that high? So his 2020 season with Red Bull, he finished P4 in Abu Dhabi. So there we go. That's about where it would have been. Yeah. Which would have been the last race of 2020 season. So it's nice to see Alex getting some decent results back in there.
I think like yourself, but not at the same time, because I've passed judgment a lot sooner. I didn't want to let myself get carried away in free practice and qualifying, because they did absolutely phenomenal in both of them. Not yet. Not yet. Wait for it. But then they did it. And okay, yeah, Sainz was unfortunate, but I'm, again, not worried about him. It happens, you know. And Albon's finally got a teammate who challenges him. And if this is the result, then Williams could go from strength to strength this year. And there's so much potential that even at circuits that will naturally turn to be more challenging for them. I think the key evidence of that is that, well, Sainz is obviously out of the race very early on. He then pivoted immediately and ensured that he would be there to help make sure that Albon could bring home the best result for the team possible with his strategic insights, which must just be refreshing and reassuring for him that he's now got a team that actually listens to his strategic thoughts and opinions and then applies them. So that kind of dynamic immediately is so, it's nice to see, because it's this thing of, we know as Williams that we're not going to be at the sharp end, we're not competing for Grand Prix wins and championships, we just want to get there. We can figure that out later, as Ellie May, you were saying earlier with McLaren, it's kind of, you've got to go through those motions when you get to that stage, you can't go through them sooner. So they're maximizing what they know and what they're trying to get to in the meantime, and we're kind of on, what was it, 2014 Williams territory at the moment, or we're getting near to that, and that's quite a nice thought.
I'm praying that Australia wasn't a fluke for this team and that's their actual pace. Because I think if you look back at the last few years, that car likes Australia when the drivers aren't crashing.
Cars like the circuit when they're not crashing, don't they?
No, but it's been a track that previously Williams have been good at. So I kind of hope it's not just like track specific.
We'll find out soon enough.
I know.
But I think even if it is track specific, there's enough circuits this year for them to still make a step up. They got 17 points in all of last year, and they've already got, what, 10 off the back of this now? So the fact that they've done that in one race, it's kind of, as we get on to, the same with Sauber. It's kind of, even if you do badly, you're still probably going to do a shit ton better than you did last year.
Yeah,
and they've got some good drivers to do it with as well. So
yeah, 10 points here compared to 17 last year, and in 2022 they only scored 8. So they're doing a lot better than that. So yeah, it's a jumbled up, shook up world for Williams, as it sort of is for Aston Martin, where it's sort of jumbled up and shook up because these are not the drivers we expected to do those things. Alonso qualified 12th, Lance Stroll qualified just behind him 13th. So far, so normal. Then Lance Stroll finishes P6. Not hugely out of the blue, but Alonso DNFs, drops it in the rain.
Easy mistake to make when you're a rookie.
Yeah, this is true. Got to remember, he is a rookie.
I've written over the hedge in my notes here, because Lance Stroll reminded me of Vern from the film of the same name. As soon as he gets over said hedge and wonders what on earth the place is that he's just discovered and how on earth he got there, because that just felt like Lance Stroll in P6. Everyone, including himself, are going, how on earth did I get here? This isn't where I belong. This isn't where I usually turn up. So I don't want to say the sentence, but I'm going to have to say the sentence, credit where it's due. He somehow managed to get there. Alonso, a lot like Sainz and various other drivers, I'm not worried about. It happens. But Lance Stroll, as we fear for Williams, I don't think that it's going to be a one-off result for them. I think this is more likely to be a one-off result, and normal business will be resumed next week. And hopefully he doesn't go into the back of any Aussies for no particular reason.
Stroll just got on with the race quietly, really. There was no heroics, but there was also nothing to moan about either. He likes a greasy track. Think of Turkey in 2020.
Well, to be fair, he has a good race every 4 or 5 years, and now he's filled that quota again, so If he stood around in 2030, that's when we start got to worry about him next.
Well, I mean, it's his daddy's team. Of course, he's going to be there in 2030. But yeah, I mean, yeah, Lance likes a greasy tracker, but how do you ignore Brazil last year? And there have been some other heroics from Lance on sort of wet or surprisingly changeable conditions. He did a lot of karting up in, I want to say, Yorkshire when he was young. So he will be used to sort of wet, cold, greasy, unfavourable conditions. So no surprises there. And yeah, last year he earned 24 points all in. So he's already earned a quarter of last year's tally, which is quite impressive. But yeah, that surprising error from Alonso, but proof that the wet curbs and the lines around the park bite even the most experienced. The midfield scrap this year could be one for the ages. I'm not saying the Aston Martin's fast, but what I'm saying is that Alonso might be able to sort of joust about with the other teams that we've seen enjoy a bit of a turnaround in performance and prospects, namely, possibly, maybe, very small chance. Also, Kick Sauber. Bortoleto qualified 15th and eventually DNF'd. Hülkenberg qualified 17th and would finish 7th, which means that the team has outscored itself from last year. Nicely enough.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Who knew we would be talking about them so soon and before Ferrari?
Yes, the highest finishing Ferrari power.
Don't expect that to carry on for too long.
Yeah, it is
well,
interesting that the team that is essentially just a giant advert for online gambling finished higher than the people who give them their engines, but there we go.
Yeah, I despite what Ellie May. Despite what anybody might think, I've not made a Hannah Montana reference with my comments on Kick Sauber here. This is just me saying that they do have the best of both worlds because there's no pressure on them at all. As I said with Bortoleto earlier, as a rookie coming in and arguably the worst car on the grid, and this kind of shows that they just get on with things. You know, there's no pressure on them, and that was shown from the off with Bortoleto knocking Antonelli out in Q1 and Hulk performing pretty well in the FP sessions. In the Grand Prix, like most of the rookies, Bortoleto had a baptism of fire, needed it, they all do, because then they can get on with learning and get on with things for next time. But I do wonder if the lack of pressure or expectation on both drivers for this year is giving them freedom to go out and just do what every driver wants to be able to do, and that is just drive. And you saw that with Hulk in particular. He doesn't care at the best of times, he just gets on with it, and you've got to love that about him. And he just did it, and you say, gets points, immediately outscores combined outage of a team from last year with two drivers. And if you're Bottas, that's as smart a little bit, but it's also very amusing as someone who goes, I don't know why they didn't hire me. That's why. You didn't do that once last year. You couldn't even get 10th.
Yeah. It's the one thing that really hangs over me from Stakes' performance across the weekend was how Bortoleto's suspension was broken before he crashed. I think I'd sort of go back and watch the entire sort of lap or so.
The wheel kind of came off before
he'd actually
crashed properly, and you went, eh?
It looked like he might have been able to save it had his rear suspension on the right-hand side not just gone and skittered off on its own accord. He might have clipped a wall or brushed a curb slightly too strongly earlier on. That might have been enough to dislodge it, but everyone else has been sort of brushing walls and clipping curbs. So maybe it was just a carbon fiber control that hadn't cured properly. We'll wait and see. But I don't want to call it promising things for Sauber, but I think it does go to show that if we have another few of those sort of crazy races, there is an opportunity that they might be able to be in the right place to capitalize on it. So all is not lost for them as an outfit, but it does mean that the pressure is on for the teams that are currently behind them, which starts that section of the list with Ferrari. Leclerc qualified 7th, Hamilton 8th, not too bad, and then finished 8th and 10th respectively. Oh, I will say, though, best Hamilton of the weekend, Anthony, and his consoling of a distraught Isaac Hadjar. I will say, in a world where you can be one of two people, be an Anthony Hamilton and not a Jos Verstappen. If you've got a choice of which dad...
Or a Helmut Marko.
If you've got a choice of which dad to be an Anthony Hamilton. Elsewhere, the usual Ferrari disaster class, really, as things changed faster than they could keep track of, and their gambles just kept coming up flat. A car that wasn't set up right struggled to be proving the necessary sort of platform that the drivers wanted, especially compared to the McLaren. It's early doors, but I fear I could be in for another year of troubled Tifosi membership, especially if Brian Bozzi's radio call of, what was it,
It was a classic bit of Ferrari team radio, though. That was has to go down in the book of quotes and the book of wise words, as Leclerc said.
Yeah, that goes into the book of wise words. I'm like,
this, I've got a leak. What is it? Water. Do you know where it's from? Must be the water.
Yeah, it must be the water.
Spiffing insight.
Cheers, Brian, for that one. But yeah, it's. Oh, I think this is the worst Ferrari debut for a driver for Hamilton since, I want to say, 2008. When, who is it who joined Ferrari in 2008? I can't remember off the top of my head.
Maestro Kimi.
No, it. Oh, there must have been someone else. Was it 2008? It might have been before 2008. It was certainly within the 2000s. Brief pause while I do some thinking. I might be able to remember who it was. I think it was Bedoa. But the 2000s seemed too early for that. Anyway, there was someone who has had a worse entry to Ferrari that, did not get on well with it.
I mean, let's add that to the words of wisdom just about sums up their weekend for them, doesn't it? I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, I cannot take away any positives from this weekend. I mean, at least Hamilton now knows where the K1 button is, but he couldn't even...
Christ, that was such an annoying team radio. Like, my God, man, leave him alone.
But the thing is he didn't even need to deploy it because he didn't have enough... Mm. He wasn't near Albon to deploy more energy for the overtake.
I did like how polite he was, but you could hear the irritation creep in. It's like, please leave me alone. It's like someone just trying to interrupt your conversation. I'm just trying to enjoy my dinner. Just go away, please. I'm just trying to get on with things.
Let's see how long that lasts.
Kimi would be great on the as a race engineer instead, because you know you're just getting what you need, and he's going to leave you the hell alone the rest of the time.
I was right. It was
that's where the key is.
It was Luca Badoa in 2009 because he replaced.
Oh, yeah, because he came in for Massa. Yeah.
At the European Grand Prix and finished 17th. So it could be worse.
Nothing against Mr. Badoa, but we probably weren't expecting that much anyway.
No. Yeah, odd one. Yeah, his son, Brando, is now in.
Yeah, he's in Formula 3.
Three these days, isn't he? Yeah. Thought as much.
Just made his debut.
Yes.
But Ferrari, yeah. Silver lining, they didn't crash and they looked good in the free practice session. I know it's not much, but it's something, so we're just going to take it and move on. Hamilton's spin in Q2 was a little uncharacteristic as well. And like you say, the Q3 results, they weren't bad, but they just weren't what we expected. But I wonder, Benny May's already said yes to this, but are we just as a collective fan base a little bit to blame for how they did, because we just assumed that, oh, it's Hamilton, it's Leclerc, it's Ferrari, it's Vasseur. 1-2 immediately, we're going to be sorted, guys. It's our year out the gates. It's going to be perfect. And anything less than that is not on for us, and we're going to go, oh, bugger. I wonder maybe if we'd tempered expectations slightly, if we'd be as annoyed. Probably still annoyed, but just maybe not as annoyed. I think... Yeah, the team radio obviously wasn't good. The missed opportunity of strategy did make me scratch my head a little bit, and obviously I wasn't the only one because Hamilton was going, why are we doing what we're doing here? But I'm going to put this down to teething issues, getting better into a new team. Leclerc's used to this by now, as you could tell from the humour with which he addressed the whole water leakage situation, and he's kind of, right, I'll just get over this, I suppose, then we'll figure this out later. But remember, McLaren did have a shaky start to the last year. By the end of the season, that was all a long way in the rearview mirror. So that's all I'm going to say on that one. Maybe that's a morsel of hope that Ellie May can clutch onto until we see how they do in China. She's pulling a face that makes me think that's not going to be as straightforward as I want that to be, but I'll be the optimistic one.
No, I was more thinking, if Sainz was there, do you think he would have said no?
You're still on this.
No, but do you think he would have said, no, I'm pitting?
The Probably, but he'd also kind of been used to that at that point as well, yeah. Whereas Hamilton, maybe, he's witnessed all of this, but he's not had to experience it. And going back to what you say about Lando early, you've got to go through it to then get into that Sainz headspace, if you will.
Yeah, you've got to experience it to know how to deal with it. I think to put it all in internet phrases, we overhyped based off of aura farming, and unfortunately it came up a bit of an L, so... yeah, not what we wanted for Ferrari.
Ellie May, translate that, please.
We forgot that the Ferrari strategists exist.
Thank you.
Forgotten they've got a pit wall made up of a posse of clowns. But anyway, could be worse. You could be Alpine, who Gasly qualified 9th, Doohan 14th, Gasly finished P11th, and Doohan DNF'd.
I'm not as worried about them.
That's what's written in front of me. Gasly finished P11.
Yeah, but you said 11th.
11th. Yeah, I combined P11 and 11th. It's a hybrid phraseology that I'm pioneering. It's cutting edge things you
Don't
can
think that's
do.
catching on.
It will not, almost certainly.
I'm not too worried about Alpine, and I'll tell you why, because I think they're a great pairing, first of all. The haircut's lovely, matching. No, it's got nothing to do with the bush, it's a fun touch. And there was a lot of potential there, and they just, I think, just a bit of bad luck. I would have loved to have seen, for example, what Doohan could have done in Q2 if it wasn't for Hamilton's spin. He looked like he was on for a decent lap. And okay, yeah, the really neat placement on his car as well did kind of pick me over, and I really like the helmet that he's got for this season. So I think aesthetics wise, they've got it nailed down. I know I missed the livery review, but that Alpine, I feel like they nailed the look finally of blue and pink. It took them enough attempts to crack it, but I think they finally got something that looks great. And I just think it was bad luck for Gasly at the end. If it wasn't for Piastri coming back through and all these kind of circumstances and the rain, it caught out so many people at the end that he was doing fairly decent up to that point. And Doohan, again, rookie, changing conditions, baptism of fire. Stuff was going to happen, but I don't know. I've just got something with Alpine this year, whereas I don't want Briatore to do well, but I'm willing to allow it to happen if it means that Gasly and Doohan can capitalize on it, because I see something there that I didn't see with him and Ocon or with the entire outfit in previous years, and it felt like they still carried over that momentum from the end of last season. They weren't racing boys. They weren't Haas and Sauber for the good they had with this one. They didn't luck into it, but they capitalized on the opportunity that came their way. Whereas Alpine just happened to be the team on the bad end of that. And you know that if you put either of those Alpines up against the Aston Martins, they're probably going to be ahead. So I think it's just one of those unfortunate things.
Was it Doohan that got caught up with the Hamilton spin with the
Yeah,
yellow
in Q2.
flag? Yeah, and then obviously then he had traffic in sector
Yeah.
three.
Yeah, he
So
just
we never got to see sort
exactly
of what
running.
he had done.
Was thinking he was on a good lap up to that point, but then obviously it gets compromised. Yeah,
Okay.
that's another one of those what if laps. A little bit like Hamilton's earlier on qualifying, where he went purple in that first sector and then he just backed off and go, no, I want to see what you can do.
But yeah, I do like, I will agree though, I do like Doohan's helmet. I do like the replica of what was his dad's MotoGP helmet from the 500 series. It's a nice looking helmet, the lovely stripes on it, and it sort of works with the rest of the Alpine livery. But yeah, I
I
still
do
haven't.
think that Alpine as well need to do better PR or come out better as a unified force, because obviously Doohan's got all these question marks over his future. And while he's a very strong mental character, because obviously his dad's a pretty strong mental character and it's transferred over, as you saw, Alpine could do with putting it to bed, regardless of what's going on internally, give that unified force outside, because that just, I know there's technically no such thing as bad publicity, but you. There's also a lot of advantages to having a unified front and some good publicity in the fact that they just didn't do anything about that with all these constant questions for Doohan. Just goes, he's already got enough pressure as it is. You're the team that's hired him in the first place. Maybe
At least,
just
yes, we are staying
be
with
on
him.
his side.
Yeah, there is that question over it, but I still haven't figured out where Gasly came from at one point in that race. He ended up sort of like P3 for a while.
P3.
It's kind of mad.
Here's what Hamilton, Leclerc, Gasly, and you go, let's leave it there, guys. That works for me.
Where did that go? But yeah,
Will again?
the car doesn't look terrible. It's just a shame that it bit the very inexperienced Doohan, who's only really known the previous car in warm, dry conditions, and then this one in similar conditions again in Bahrain. Cold and wet, not ideal for learning the ropes on a precarious car that's been set up, well, so far, in a miscalibrated wind tunnel. So he's not had the best run up to this weekend, which isn't what you'd want for your home Grand Prix. And like Lawson at Red Bull Racing, my worries are not for his ability, but for the ruthlessness that comes from above and the ruthlessness that may be cut by Briatore. I want to see more from Doohan. Given what he's already shown this weekend gone, I think there is a lot more to be shown from him. He's a nice guy.
My only comfort from the four potential replacements for him is that Colapinto does crash as well and has proven that. Like, he does good, but he does also crash. Paul Aaron isn't that experienced. Kushmaini is better than we expected, but it's a big difference going into F1. And then the third, fourth driver, whose name I do know, but keep forgetting, that's the one. It's not going to be him.
He's only really testing anyway, because he's also signed on with McLaren for testing with them. So I can't see anyone putting him in.
So I just look at who you could replace him with and go, what is the immediate benefit that you want? Colapinto is the best bet, but also he's proven that he can be good, but he's proven he's also very capable of crashing in the same conditions that Doohan just crashed in.
If Doohan stays clean, doesn't necessarily have to have huge stellar performances, but if he's not writing off a chassis every other weekend, I reckon...
Which, I mean, this crash didn't, I don't think.
Again, it was cargo's round...
There was a lot of crashing. It was hard to keep track of who did what.
I think his was just sort of cargo's round rear wing into a barrier. It wasn't like sort of obliterated.
Wasn't Colapinto Brazil.
No, it wasn't all four corners off the car. It was sort of maybe replace a few axles and wishbones and a rear wing and a bit of floor. I don't think we're talking about sort of new gearbox, please. And we've only done one race. So, yeah, it could have been a hell of a lot worse for Doohan. I think he's come out of this weekend, what was a challenging home Grand Prix for him as well, looking
you'd be pretty happy with himself. I think you combine the physical challenge and the mental challenge off track and you go, not too bad, kid.
Yeah, not the worst outcome.
Big kid, he's what, 21? He's not a kid, but you know.
122. Something like that.
Good job, slugger. There we go. It's more appropriate.
Keep it up, ace. Meanwhile, we get to the penultimate team on the list, Racing Bulls. Yuki Tsunoda smacks it into Q5. Why have you written it as
Q5?
P5 or 5th in
Q5. You're not good with this, are you?
No, because you've written out... Because I'm so used to saying Q1.
Yeah, to try and keep it easy for you, and apparently it's not simple enough.
Just write quali-5. Qualifying came 5th.
I would have thought the Q would have worked perfectly well for that, but I'm clearly crediting you with too much intelligence.
The Q designation is already used for something else in what we're talking about. You're giving things too many names. It's like trying to...
Qualified in 5th. Q5.
No. Tsunoda qualified 5th and ultimately ended up finishing in P12. Meanwhile, Isaac Hadjar qualified 11th, a decent showing from him as a rookie, but then immediately DNF'd on... Well, actually, no, he does not DNF, he DNF'd.
I was going to say, I was so hopeful for a moment that I thought, this doesn't impact my world prediction because he technically didn't start the Grand Prix, and then obviously that didn't last too long anyway. But I just thought, I appreciate you doing it now and not later.
No,
unlike the other drivers.
He did not start the races, technically. His crash happened on the formation lap. And very much a story of what could have been. I feel so sorry for Hadjar, not just because of that formation lap spin, because also Crofty seemed entirely unable to say his name all race long. It's Hadjar, like Jar, not like...
You can tell he doesn't watch Formula 2, because the commentary for last year, not having that problem once.
So ever. Yeah, everyone calls him Isaac Hadjar, as opposed to Isaac Hadjar.
Is that because it's his name?
Yeah, that's how you say his name. It's not a tricky name to pronounce. All the vowel sounds exist in English.
Did the same happen for you, that whenever you heard him mispronounce it, you thought of the Badger, Badger, Badger song?
A little bit, yes.
Because that kept popping into my head, which was quite annoying at that time in the morning. So I'm going, why is this the song stuck in my head, man?
Yes, also because I have currently got a trail camera set up in my granddad's garden to watch a badger that is currently digging a hole.
Badger, Badger, Badger.
Yeah. I'm going to have to rename the badger, the badger in Granddad's garden, the Isaac Badger, because that's quite funny. But anyway, challenging conditions for a pure rookie to start in, and it was likely going that way anyway, given the other rookies and how they fared. But I wanted for him to have a fair crack at it nonetheless. Tsunoda seems really up for this season, and if he keeps putting in performances like these, Red Bull might pull the trigger, or another outfit might, given how Zach Brown was speaking about him. The VCarb isn't actually supposed to be that good this year, according to my factory insider, so this is regarded as a bit of a surprise for the team. And given that Isaac Badger was up there in qualifying, suggests that this wasn't a fluke on the half of Yuki either, with Aston Martin seemingly back to a competent base car, Alpine on the right path and Williams able to run with the pack, and maybe Sauber having a chance. There's a lot to play for this year, I feel.
It was just unimaginably painful on both sides of the garage, to be honest. I mean, I think both of them did pretty well in qualifying. Hajar being obviously the fastest rookie in 11th, and Yuki putting together a blinder of a lap to qualify in 5th. It just all fell apart on Sunday. I feel awful for Hajar. I mean, I don't blame him for the mistake at all. It's so easily done in the wet on very slippery street circuit with painted lines everywhere. It was just one of those things. Equally, Yuki didn't put a foot wrong really the whole race. It was the strategist who kept him out in the rain for too long that then caused the damage and him to fall out the points. It was just a whole...
I'll counter that a little bit just with the experience level he's got now, and because he's so embedded with that team, he maybe should have questioned it a little bit, or have the authority, or feel like he should leave out the authority. I mean, maybe we did and we just didn't hear it on team radio. I know we don't obviously hear everything, but to question if that's the best decision or not. I mean, he's not known for not being outspoken, so I'm curious there how much say he got in the matter as well there. I mean,
yeah,
we might just not know.
You could say the same then about Ferrari.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, Ferrari, Christ, let's not go down there again. We're already sad enough as it is with them, but yeah, that's that. If this kind of thing, if Yuki should be able to do that, then they definitely should, and I'm not going to be giving Ferrari a free pass on that one, but it goes back to what I was saying earlier. You can be brilliant at qualifying, but that doesn't matter one iota if you can't translate it onto the Sunday. And yeah, Hadra, unfortunate. But I don't think necessarily that that's the advertisement you want to give if you're Yuki either. I mean, it's great to qualify, and it's great for Zach Brown to be able to shit stir a little bit, but if you're starting that high up and then being beaten by Williams, a Kick Sauber, and Lance, I don't know how I got here, Stroll, then I don't think that's necessarily the way you want to show up management why they should hire you. I mean, I'm not saying he should have finished 5th, but 9th or 10th would have been nice, and to be that close, but no cigar again, it shows where his obvious strength is this weekend and where his obvious weakness is, and being in the same team for that long, you'd maybe hope for a little bit more.
But I don't think the weakness was on his racing ability. It was that
not
they...
completely. No, I'm just saying again, because we don't know how much he questioned the strategy, how much the strategy. There's inter-team stuff there, I admit, and I'd probably say it's what 60-40 on the team rather than on him. But at the same time, I still feel like you've got certain drives where you go through the motions enough, you should then question when you. I mean, if he didn't question it, then I've got more questions about him. Obviously, we didn't hear everything, so
it was 100% on the team. they have the information on the weather, and they can see that everyone else is pitting because it's the sensible option, because it's raining on a slippery track and you're on slicks. Nah, they should have pitted. It's on them, not
you should have questioned. I'm not saying it's entirely his fault. I'm just saying it would be nice to know how much he questioned it so that I can then say one way or the other.
And bear in mind that when it comes to strategy, Mercedes had someone stood on the beach a couple of miles away with literally holding their hand up to the sky so they knew when the rain was coming before it got to the circuit.
I knew Bottas would come in handy.
Maybe that's what they had him doing throughout the entire weekend. But essentially, there are ways of sort of dealing with that and making those calls a lot more accurately. Mercedes were pretty spot on when it came to their calls when it was for sort of wet compounds for dry compounds. And again, just sort of having that bit of experience. It's not like Racing Bulls are lacking in experience. Racing Bulls as an outfit have been in this sport for 2 decades now, plus a bit more, I should think. And again, they're pulling on experienced sort of professionals from Red Bull as well. There's no reason they shouldn't have been able to make those sensible calls that would have helped Yuki. But I don't know, I feel that there's a lot of potential here that they might fritter away this year.
They already have.
They might do it again. Speaking of potential, or a team that doesn't actually seem to have any at the moment based off of that weekend's performance, the last team on our list, I'm so sorry, Henry, Haas. Ocon qualified 19th, while Behrmann technically did not qualify and ended up starting with a pit lane. And Ocon would then finish P13 and Behrmann would finish P14. Pain.
We're just being tested.
Oh, pain is all I feel.
I don't know who he was in a past life, but he is being tested.
Yeah. The car just wasn't there. The setup wasn't there. They fell to peer pressure when it came to ditching the Inters, only to then have to go back to them anyhow. They were sort of clinging on to the slicked immediates. They even said it on the radio at one point. I think one of the teams said slicked immediates. And I was like, that'll be what you need just to get through one big downpour and then stick with them. And instead, they were sort
no,
of like...
No, you misunderstood. They were combining those together. It was slicked immediates with the same tyre in their mind. It was a combination of the two.
They thought there was yet another tyre they might be able to utilise as opposed to be a worn-down pair of Inters. Had they stuck with them, they might have been all right. They wouldn't have lost out on a lot of positions by doing the pit stops, especially out of sync with everyone else, because it just saw them tumble down the order. Kudos, though, to Behrmann for being one of just two rookies to keep it on the island. Nice work, really. But at the end of the day, it's nice work for a very small pool of work that is decent to pick from.
Yeah, that was kind of what was in my notes. Sort of a well done to Behrmann for being only one of two rookies to get all the way through the race. I mean, obviously he didn't get off to the best starts, crashing in FP1, not taking part in FP2, not taking part
crashing
in
in FP3.
crashing in FP3. So he didn't have a lot of experience around here, and yet he pulled it back for the race to finish when so many didn't in horrible conditions. And I think that's the only positive you can really take, and Ocon was there.
It just baffled me that they, in all of testing and free practice, not once did they think, did we do any qualifying runs with either car? No? No? All right, we'll just, we'll figure it out later. Maybe we should have done that. Well, never mind. And then, like you say, Ocon was there, and you go, I was already not excited about that driver move in the first place, and now I'm somehow less excited for it. It was just so many questions of the whole weekend. You'd go, okay, all these teams have some positives to take from their weekend in some respects. You look at Racing Boys, you've got at least your qualifying was good. Your Ferrari, you go, you were bad, but you still got points. You look at, you know, Aston Martin, you go, Lance Stroll somehow came through for you. You look at Haas and you've got to go with the fact that you just didn't crash. And you go, that's kind of the bare minimum anyway. For most of the time, especially from an outfit that should know what they're doing by now, and I just get a bad feeling that that is going to be something that continues, where they'll finish races, but they'll be, dare I say it, the new Kvyat.
We underestimate how well Hülkenberg and Magnussen pulled that car through last year.
Mm-hmm.
Quite possibly.
Well, again, it goes back to the question with Haas, with Williams, with Alpine, with Sauber as well, car versus driver, and how much of it is one, how much of it is the other. And if this is anything to go by, like you said, Hülkenberg Magnussen last year show it's more the driver in that particular instance.
There's just a lot to try and turn around for them, really. Anyway, with the teams sifted through, we'll dive into winners and spinners. And Ellie May, I'll let you start with your winner first.
I've gone for Kimi Antonelli. I think despite the struggle in qualifying with damage to the floor that was obviously cost him a lot of speed going down the straights, he put a great performance in the race. And, you know, one of the few drivers to actually overtake in the race as well. And Australia is a hard place to overtake in the dry, let alone the wet. And with the good strategy that Mercedes had as well, he was able to climb his way up to fourth, and it's not bad from 16th on the grid. I mean, it's made him the second youngest point scorer on the grid. And out of the five youngest point scorers, he's got the highest place finish. And that's against people like Verstappen, Lando Norris, who are the youngest point scorers in F1.
It's a fair shout. And I think Antonelli's performance was one that was outstanding from the crowd this weekend. Timo, you've picked two for your winner.
It felt rude to choose one but not the other, really. So Albon and Hülkenberg, we don't need to go into why. We know why. They did a bloody excellent job, so that's why they get it from me.
Nice. And I've gone for Norris. It's a relatively obvious straight down the middle choice, but I think that his performance speaks for itself. Apart from that one brief outing into the gravel during that downpour, he was pretty clean and pretty determined this weekend, and I think throughout the way that he approached the weekend has been phenomenal, and sort of I think his overall performance from sort of Friday through to end of Sunday was worthy of note and merit. So I think for me, he gets my winner's trophy. Spinners, Ellie May, yours.
So I've gone for Racing Bulls, but only Yuki Strategist, because Yuki had one hell of a qualifying performance and maintained that in the race until his strategist kept him out in the rain for too long. It just meant that he fell down the order, and it just cost them a huge chunk of points when they're really going to need it being a midfield team. And my other spin is Helmut Marko for saying that Hadjar getting upset after his crashing out in the race was embarrassing. Emotions aren't embarrassing, Helmut.
It was.
You wouldn't know. He's never had an ish.
It annoys me that he won Le Mans in a Porsche 917.
Ruins the car for you.
Mm.
Timo, your spinner. Yeah, I think
diabolical.
Not a good weekend to be Haas. For me, Ferrari, you've got that driver lineup. This is your first weekend with it, and that's how you fumble it. I think we all expected better, and I think we also all deserved better. They should know better as well.
Our fault, Jesse. We expected too much from them.
Too much, but at the same time, your Ferrari, you should be able to do better, and that was
yes,
not.
But we should know better as well.
But they should also know that Lewis knows better. They should be able to trust
him. Yes, but we've known that for ages.
My luck. I'm still allowed to be annoyed by them, even if I do know better than to try and think positively about Ferrari. Anyway, predictions review. It was a point for each of you. No, 2 points for Ellie May, 1 point for Timo this week. Ellie May gets hers for Lando Norris pole and Grand Prix win. Timo gets his for fastest lap. We're still awarding points for fastest lap, though Formula One may not be. Then we get to...
Martin Brundle's not happy about it either. He still thinks it should be there.
Yeah, so he can join the club. He can come on the podcast and tell us about it. In fantasy world, though, we've got our fantasy Formula One league back. We've got some different names appearing in it. And Lando is winning with 194 points.
I don't
even know how to pronounce that one. It is a combination of letters. 193 points and Jalogish.
Everything is a combination of letters, Jesse. Come on.
This is true, but this is an incomprehensible combination of letters. And Jalogish,
that's better.
187. Meanwhile, we've done a bit better with Can't Grow a Moustache, P4, Hopeful Heroes, P10, Timo's podcast.
You say we've done better. I didn't put the points deliberately because it's abysmal for everyone, for obvious reasons.
Especially Can't Grow a Moustache did well.
Yeah, P4.
Oh, yeah, everyone from like P4 down there.
Yeah. Red Bull Rejects, P42. Ellie May, this is one of your teams with minus 40 points.
They've taken over from the greatest mustache, which was consistently last year.
You've kind of done an accidental Team Penske tribute for IndyCar last year, who got minus points off the back of the first round of the season last year, and then had to work their way back up. So
yes,
I appreciate the reference, but I don't think that was deliberate.
Yeah, well, Jesse sent me the points that Red Bull Rejects got after qualifying, and they were my second highest team.
Yeah, they look great after qualifying.
I had a similar thing, because that looked great for my first team, and then you couldn't have written it better or worse. Each driver that then DNF'd at the start of the race just kept being one of mine from that team, to which point I was simmed to death with Hülkenberg and my two constructors, and going, this isn't looking good, guys. It's not looking good at all. And I'm going, I really, really should have named this something along the lines of the Suicide Squad instead, because it feels more apt to describe how this is going.
Ellie May's Red Bull Reject. She's got 26.2 million left under the cost cap, scored minus 40 this weekend. Sainz, Albon, Sonoda, Hadjar, Gasly, Williams, and Racing Bulls. Only Gasly, Albon, and Williams actually scored positive points this weekend. Yuki Tsunoda doesn't even... just breaks even. He scores zero. Sainz being double scores minus 38, and a Hadjar minus 20, and Racing Bulls minus 10.
I'm not sure which of your teams it was, Jesse, but I did look just to see the points break down, and I think it was Haas got 14 points for finishing, and then Alpine got minus 14, so it's cancelled each other out. Never mind.
Yeah, I did have a few teams that sort of very barely broke even, so an interesting start to the Fantasy Formula One season. Meanwhile, over in Feeder Series Corner, we of course had Formula Two and Formula Three for the first time ever kicking off their seasons down under. In Formula Two, it's probably too early to really start calling things here, but it's an interesting season that's coming towards us, it looks like. Penalties that should have been served in the feature race from testing infringements have been dropped, though Victor Martins does claim his pole position points, as technically that was only the qualifying session. If you paid any attention across the weekend, you'd know that the wet weather caused the Formula 2 feature race to be abandoned. They did multiple laps behind the safety car and eventually they just went, nah, this ain't happening. Was comical and worth staying up for, I'm sure, Timo.
Oh, you know what? At that point, I'd got past the point of tiredness. It was day three of this slog and I didn't mind at all and got some excellent commentary from Mr. Brundle about Australian woodland ducks, as we mentioned at the top of the episode. So what was there not to love?
I was going to say, I would like a podcast that is Chris McCarthy and Alex Brundle just commentating on anything. Just like put them in a shopping centre.
It's still a bit like Alex Jakes and Alex Brundle last year, I think in Monaco or the year before. They had a lot of time to fill and they found a way. They can talk all right.
They are good time fillers and entertaining time fillers. If we could just sit them down somewhere with a microphone, just have them commentate on the world going past them, it would be entertainment. Meanwhile, speaking of entertainment, Formula 3, and oh boy, I am excited for this year's action. Roman Belinsky snuck up on me out of nowhere. Did not see him coming into the
scene. Noticed that.
And little gem of a driver. Seeing some great sophomore drivers in this as well, really turning up the wick on their performances. I feel a little bad for being so critical of many of them last year as well. The new chassis.
No, you've got to embrace it. That's how they learn.
This is true. They do listen to the podcast. They do come away more learned drivers from this. That new chassis looks pretty raceable, though. I'm looking forward to seeing how it settles and how.
Curious, actually, for your thoughts on maybe Ellie Mays, if she's seen the car as well. From the back, they, to me, reminded me of a combination of cars you'd see in the Golf Historic and the 2014-15 F1 cars. And I thought, sometimes they say, oh, we've got a new car, and you go, is it? You can't really tell. But this one, like, from the front, not as much, but from the back, I just thought, you look more Formula One-ish or more classic-y Formula One-ish.
Let me see if I can get a shot from the rear.
Get that and use it inappropriately.
It's a little bit.
Certain angles, certain shots more than others, but it's more boxy than how else to describe it.
Yeah, if you stripped a bit of the cowl off, so you had sort of the exposed exhaust at the back, I can see why it's a bit classic-y. It looks good. It steps in the right direction, I think, and it's providing a more interesting and balanced platform for the latest generation F3 car. So, yeah. It seems to have settled in a lot better than the F2 car did when that was introduced last. So, a lot better there. I can't remember what they're running. They're still Mechachrome 3.4, six cylinders, aren't they? 380 horsepower. But they are now... what are they running? They're on 100% sustainable fuel now as well, which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And they've got a slightly different tire compound, I believe. They're on a slightly more sustainable compound, I think, as well for them. But anyway, that's the world of Formula 3 and Formula 2, which of course was launched this weekend, just gone, and the weekend coming, we're going to see Formula 1 Academy kick off its third publicly broadcast series. We've got a few returning faces.
Second publicly broadcast series.
Third series.
We didn't get the first season.
Broadcast, yes. And of course, we've got a lot of returning names, but also a lot of new ones as well. So some old scores still to settle. I'm putting money on Meyer Werg for this one, I think, now that we've got a couple of other names sort of shuffling on. I don't know how well Doran Pan's going to go this year, but Meyer Werg looks pretty tasty for a champion.
We will obviously talk more about feeder series as the season goes on. We're going to try and do it at strategic points throughout the year and then talk about the main headlines and what we can remember and try and have a bit more of a discussion that way about it and try and bundle them all together and so it's not too much... In each episode, I'm just going to mention highlights between now and then. If anything pops up, that's going to be yet another new approach. So we're going to try and take a try and crack this particular one for this year.
We'll see how we go. See if we can make some interesting feeder series content. But that is all still to come, as is the Chinese Grand Prix. We're heading back to Shanghai in a few short days. You'll be recording it later this week, a preview for that Grand Prix, so I'll get some predictions laid down ahead of it. Otherwise, in the meantime, Ellie Mae, where can the people find you?
Trying to catch up on sleep between Australia and China.
Put yourself on China time. It's the only way to do it.
Yeah, it just sort of slowly works you back to sort of European time. Timo, where can the people find you if they want more Timo content?
Primarily at the moment, everything F1. There's some Australia F1 and feeder series content out for that, and there'll be some F1 and F1 Academy China content for that over the course of the weekend.
Excellent stuff. And if you want more from me by the time you listen to this, you'll be able to pick up the last of last week's Classic Car Weeklies, or look ahead to the first of this week's Classic Car Weeklies, which has a big preview of the Classic Car Restoration Show, which I will be at with Bridget the Midget. We'll be in Hall 5 on the Classic Car Weekly stand. There is plenty
There's a lot of restoration.
Not a restoration. A restoration undergoing at the moment, but I will not be working on it across the weekend.
I thought that was you going, that's not a restoration and you can't call them that anymore.
Not allowed to call them that. They're works in progress. I'll be at the NEC over the weekend, but I will be enjoying the Chinese Grand Prix fitted in around it. Otherwise, I'm down at Goodwood on Wednesday. If anyone listening to this is heading to the HRDC track day, I'll be around there. So enjoying a lot of classic cars going zoom around a very beautiful circuit in hopefully spring sunshine. And then hopefully I will also be going zoom in a classic racing car with Le Mans winner Tom Christensen giving me some pointers on how to enjoy a classic racing Mini. Otherwise, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode. We'll be back with a preview for the Chinese Grand Prix in a few short days. Thank you very much for listening.